If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests, and the legendary CHML newsroom Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML.
All right. Everybody's still talking about the eclipse and everything that went on yesterday. Of course, we broke with authority and got up onto the roof of the CHML World Headquarters and got to see it from up there. And then by the time we got up there, the whole staff was up there. So, you know, was the boss? No? Well, there you go. It was a great time. And the other thing is that Hamilton, it was like one of the best places to view it because there was cloud in other areas. And as you might remember, just before, like even 15 minutes before I came on the air at 3 o'clock, things started to, the sky started to part. No, it had nothing to do with me. I know. Thank you very much. No. But as often happens, and professors explain to us, as it happens and as the heat, and you felt the heat leave the earth, the weather atmosphere can change depending on how thick the cloud is. So good news for us in the Hamilton area. We're in the primo spot, even Niagara, and we're talking to Ken Mann and down at Fort Erie. He had some clouds. So it looks like that was a great spot. Also, 67% jump in commerce in Hamilton, restaurants, all that sort of thing. So great to see, and great to see people getting out and enjoying it. And it was kind of nice to take, the attention off, some of the hardships of the day, it seems, of late in a post-pandemic world. So anyway, kudos to the Hammer. And again, all those in hospitality that rose to the occasion and again, had a booming business yesterday. All right, what else we got? The inquiry into foreign interference is continuing today. And it was funny, this kept getting pushed back. And we all thought that, or many of us thought that it was just getting watered down. And by the time, it's death by delay. By the time it makes its way through the system and every other inquiry that's going on, there's nothing left of it. However, the funny thing about the Chinese Communist Party, they just don't stop interfering. So this has just continued, the inquiry into election interference just continues to not only going on in Ottawa, but continues to be top of mind. Tomorrow, the Prime Minister testifies, and his chief of staff and some of the big brass testifying today. So it's pretty interesting what we're seeing come out. And as we heard yesterday, we've heard more in just the first few days of this than we heard saw through the entire David Johnston report, and strong language from intelligence officials over the frustration with this government because it just does not take intelligence seriously, and just lack of coordination with all of this. The other thing was way back when this broke with the Globe and Mail and Sam Cooper, when he was with Global News at that point, was who knew what when. Because this information came out and was leaked to them in some form. So when did the Prime Minister know about this? When did the staff? And now we're finding out through documents released last night that Justin Trudeau did receive briefings on foreign interference relating to Liberal MP Han Dong's riding before the 2019 election. That's before the first one. There's two where there's been election interference. The first time out. So no wonder the Prime Minister did not want anything to do with a public inquiry. You might remember when all of this broke with Sam Cooper and the Globe and Mail, Sam Cooper with Global at the time, and then the Globe and Mail, Stephen Chase, people like that. The Prime Minister brought up racism. He played the racism card and just kept trying to shove this away, was completely against any sort of public inquiry. And then when the David Johnston fiasco blew up in his face, had no choice. Now we're hearing, gee whiz, we got to get a handle on this. We got to get a handle on this. And again, we know that this benefited, even though it had no changing in the final outcome of the election. It certainly did influence the Liberals, who want them in power, albeit with a minority, certainly before they want the Conservatives, who have a much tougher stand on them. So it's going to be fascinating to see as this continues, especially as the Prime Minister testifies tomorrow, and what his chief of staff says today. But incredible that we're hearing this kind of information when at the beginning of all of this, the Prime Minister was playing the race card when these allegations were brought up. Turns out documents reveal this information was received. He had a briefing before the 2019 election. So fascinating where we find ourselves there, and who knows how this is going to move forward. All right, what else we got? And Pierre Poilievre wants the Prime Minister to meet with the premiers. He's going to introduce a motion for that. Of course, it will be defeated. This is all just grandstanding. And he wants it to be on TV. I think this would be a grand idea. I don't know. Even if it is grandstanding, it's certainly a great distraction from the reality that we have to live through on another day. So, on any other day. So I'm all for this. And I can't wait to see when an election's called and the debates between the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition. And interesting today, I'm watching Question Period because it's what I do. Jagmeet Singh, our old buddy Jagmeet Singh, leader of the NDP, who blew a gasket on the show the other day, accusing Pierre Poilievre of lying about the carbon tax that BC is paying, saying it wasn't federal, it's provincial. Well, he didn't say it was provincial. He just said it wasn't federal. Anyway, now the Prime Minister on Question Period today was accusing the NDP and Jagmeet Singh of using conservative tactics. So there's how far we've come. When the Prime Minister accuses the NDP of being like the Conservatives, what does that say about where we are in this whole fiasco? So we'll jump into that and a whole pile of other things over the course of the afternoon. Hope you hang around for it. A ban on music, as long as it's not, if it's too fast or too slow, it's being banned. Russia, that's what they're doing there. We'll see what happens. And the effect on the eclipse. Are you not just full of love and joy? Sunny ways here again. Did you see that from the PM? Oh, no. Enough. All right. Come on, Scott. Canada's defense policy has had an update, which is amazing because if there's a couple of things, well, never mind. So we'll talk about that coming up a little later on. And the youth vote. And also remember way back when we were talking about a high school in Oakville called Iroquois Ridge that one person made a complaint, so the board just decided unanimously to change the name. No debate, no whatever. It wasn't a debate about whether they were going to change the name, but what the name was going to be changed to. Well, now they've reversed all of that. When they've got some indigenous culture and education of their own. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Authorities in Russia, in the Russian Republic of Chechnya, have announced a ban on music that they would consider too fast or too slow. Only medium speed allowed. The ban will mean that many songs and musical styles and pop, techno will be banned. The president, who's been in the post since 2007, has devoted a great effort to stifling any form of dissent. To talk more about all of this, John Colarusso with us, PhD professor, anthropology, linguistics, and languages, all things Russian, and he is here now. John, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am well. Thank you, Scott.
So, John, before we get to this, what is life like in Russia now, considering where they are with the Ukraine war and the fallout from that?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, for Russia as a whole, I would think that the configuration we're seeing now is very similar to the one that took place back in 1917, 1918, right before the revolution, where there's sort of a stalled front on the Western side and everything else is repressed internally. So it's not a promising or good situation, despite the fact that Ukraine is a bit shy of manpower and weapons. But Putin's trying to motivate all this by a a doctrine of maintaining integrity of values. He sees this as a kind of value war, traditional values against what he deems to be decadent innovations. Now, let's turn to Chechnya for a second. This is a Muslim republic. It's a distinct ethnic group. They're non-Slavs. And after two devastating wars, where they were seeking some degree of independence, a kind of balance was struck between Moscow and Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, that they could have a substantial amount of internal control and autonomy as long as their leader swore absolute unflinching devotion to the Kremlin. And what Kadyrov has done is basically that. He's ruling a little fiefdom, and yet nevertheless has to somehow support and be seen as an ally of Putin. And so he's joined in on the war of values and the war of traditions, and he is trying to promote traditional Chechen dancing, most of which will fall within the tempo range that he's chosen and is promoting in some way. But there were some that were faster, perhaps, that I remember seeing. The crucial thing is that it will eliminate either romantic, slow waltzing sort of music or fast modern music. So he has chosen a kind of odd, what seems odd, venue in which to pursue his value war. But the important thing to keep in mind is that this is a people from the Caucasus. And in the Caucasus, north and south, both sides, dancing is very, very important. It's a crucial form of public interaction, public display, and social interaction. So to zero in on the dance and the tempos and all that may seem sort of bizarre to us, and it may even seem bizarre to Putin. But if you know how the Caucasus works, this is actually a crucial move, and one that will have implications for the social behavior and lives of ordinary Chechens.
What will their reaction be to this?
I think they will probably, they have a tendency to be quite autonomous and individualistic. I would imagine that they will go along with it at first because it does accommodate most of the traditional dancing. I never had the impression from the other groups I've worked with in the area that modern dance and all was particularly appealing. They all understood that the traditional dancing was a crucial dimension to their traditional identity. So I think at first they might tolerate it, but there will be the occasional eruption or resistance, and then Kadyrov will have to decide how to handle that. They'll probably do it by fairly prompt suppression of some sort, not necessarily violent, but still stepping in and talking about tradition and identity and so forth.
Is this a sign that they're losing control?
I think so. He would not have put up these barriers for tempo, slow and fast, if in fact there were not dances and stuff now taking place that were either very slow or in fact too fast, according to the traditional parameters. So I do think that this was something he felt he could perhaps enforce with minimal resistance, but there will be resistance, and he must have chosen it because there were a number of instances and that struck him as being outside the bounds of tradition. And people were taking up weird Western dancing, decadent Western dancing.
As always, thank you for the lesson. John Colarusso, PhD, Professor of Anthropology, Linguistics, and Languages, McMaster University. John, thanks so much. Be well.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. You too.
People still talking about the solar experience, the eclipse that happened yesterday. It turned out Hamilton, one of the best places to see it as far as weather and clarity of skies and such. So, and as well, commerce, restaurants, hospitality, seeing an increase of 67% over the course of the day. So, good times had by all. So how does this affect people? Some people get really, really emotional with all of this. Other, whatever. And don't know what all the fuss is about, and how dare this all interrupt a Blue Jays home opener on the same day and all that stuff. But it seems to affect us in some way. And considering where we are, a little divisive at this time in our history, what is the effect of something like this? Let's bring in Steve Jordans. Steve Jordans, professor of psychology, University of Toronto, and here now. Steve, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Great to be with you again.
So how do you explain this experience for people? Is it the fact that it is one common thing that's drawing us all together?
I mean, that's the real nice thing. I mean, what we saw yesterday, you know, we haven't really seen for a long time, maybe since like the blackouts or something, which is people just getting together to enjoy something that everybody enjoys that is non-controversial. I mean, maybe some enjoy it more than others, but I haven't heard any eclipse haters out there. And so it was a really nice opportunity, I think, for us all to become socially connected, something that we need a whole lot more of.
Obviously, we've talked at length about divisiveness and where we are in the world in a post-pandemic experience and such. Does this draw us together? Does this help in any way? Is this a step?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, I'm constantly talking about common ground, the importance of common ground, that those people that we may have differences of opinion with, it tends to be on a small subset of topics. And if we can find the ones that we agree on, well, let's live there a little bit. Let's, you know, enjoy each other and have fun on that common ground. And I think the eclipse was just one global common ground, you know, and it has all those sort of mystical kind of vibes to it, too, that I think appeal to us in the sense of, you know, not necessarily spirituality, but sort of metaphysical of thinking, you know, how we're just small people in a big universe with interesting things. So I think it's a really nice opportunity for us all to realize that in the big picture sense, you know, we're all in far more agreement over the mass of issues than we are in disagreement. And, you know, maybe we should be enjoying that agreement a little bit more than we are.
You brought up an interesting point, Steve. I feel so small. I've been when I have been fortunate enough to tour some massive churches and such in Europe, and yep. they're just unbelievable. And I remember a couple of times getting emotional. I'm thinking, why am I getting so emotional? And somebody who was a devout Catholic said, "Well, how do you feel?" And I said, "I just feel so small." Or something to that effect. And she said, "Well, I think that's the idea." So the same thing here is that it just all of a sudden the me generation looks up and thinks, wow, we're just a player in this game.
Yeah. We can get so wrapped up in our own worlds and so, you know, self-focused, and especially with social media, all the social comparisons that go on, we worry about how we're doing next to whoever. And then we have an event like yesterday where we realize, you know, we're just life forms on this planet that could disappear tomorrow and the world wouldn't miss us. Wow, that's a depressing way of saying it, isn't it? But in the grand scheme of things, you know, we're not that important. And what is important mostly when it comes down to it, and I often tell people, you know, think of yourself on your deathbed, because I do now and then. And I think, you know, am I going to look back and say, wow, those conversations I had with Scott were great? Well, maybe I will. I'm going to look back on the relationships in my life. And that's where I'm really going to be, you know, thinking about at that point in time, the work I did, the great projects, the whatever, relationships are where it really counts. And so I think yesterday we had that combination of realizing that, yes, we are as individuals are not so important in the grand scheme of things, but wow, I bet most people, and this is a point I'd like to make, you know, most of us don't understand how important social connection was, but if you had a great family day yesterday, or if you gathered with others and had a, you know, fun hours there together, realize that this is what really makes us feel good. And we may think ahead of time, oh, I'm too busy, I don't feel like, you know, going out to dinner with that other couple or whatnot. But then when you do it and you're coming home, you're like, that really makes me feel good. It's at a really deep level of our system. And so, yeah, I hope people think about that a little bit yesterday and think maybe we should find, you know, maybe let's not wait till the next eclipse. Let's find some other excuses to kind of get together with other people like that.
And talk a bit about the social media aspect of this, because we all know what that's like, whether you're going to a restaurant, everybody takes a picture of a different plate of food, different this, different that. But yeah. The social media yesterday was all the same. It might be a different foreground image, what have you, but the background was all the same. It was what we were all seeing across the planet or in the zone at the exact same time. Does this prove we can have face-to-face experiences and still be able to highlight it on social media? It doesn't have to be one extreme or the other.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I think the other cool thing about that is I often tell people there's a really simple formula for human connection, for forming a connection to another human. And that is for you and that human to have a shared emotional experience. You know, this is why kids will go to scary movies together and do karaoke, et cetera. Yesterday, everybody who you're talking about, who posted those things on social media, had a shared emotional experience. And so to some extent, an event like that can bring us together in important ways and help us all feel connected. Even to strangers on social media, you know what they felt like because you were feeling the same way. And that is, you know, really important. And I think it's cool that people are sharing and that we're realizing that commonality of experience that we all should have.
It's interesting. You talked about the theater experience, which, you know, many thought when technology took off way back when, and we could have little theaters in our homes and such that, you know, the experience of being in a movie theater would be gone. And of course, it certainly has altered. I mean, things have changed with technology, but people still want that experience of everybody being in the same big room and watching this at the exact same time.
Yeah, the emotionality, you can think of going to a ball game versus watching it on TV too. Emotionality is much more salient when you're right in the middle of it and you can see and feel other people having the same experience you're having. That brings everything up a level. It makes us feel like one, like, you know, all the theater goers are enjoying it together, or the ball fans, et cetera. So yeah. You know, that's a very important part. And it's something, again, as we live these more isolated lives all the time, we'll pick convenience over those experiences sometimes. And that's a bad trade. That's one of the things I'd like to mention. Yeah.
You talk about, you know, we use the excuse of a sports event or an event like such as yesterday, or even a theater experience. Do we still seem to see that separation, that division in everyday life? Can we bring that into our everyday life?
So sure. I mean, absolutely. In terms of, just trying to do what we can to foster that social connection. So often it's done more at an organizational level. So for example, a university can do things to really help students become more socially connected with one another and to build that sort of positivity, that community, that sense of belonging, you know, that's what feeds it all. But often, so I work with a not-for-profit called the Genwell Project, and that's what they do, is kind of look at different organizations and say, how can we create a culture that values social connection, that understands its importance, and that practices it regularly? And when you do that with some organization, when you come in there, people start to say their jobs start to feel like careers again, in the sense that they feel connected to that workplace or whatever. They feel like they belong. If you don't, you know, if you're just working from home all the time, you're probably getting your work done very fine, very well. But if you're never seeing the other employees, you probably just feel a little disconnected and isolated off to the side. And your job feels like a job. That's the sort of risk. So yes, you can do it, but you have to really work at it. And the first step is making people just understand how important that social connection is to their well-being.
Steve Jordan's with us, professor of psychology, University of Toronto, the day after the eclipse and the effect of it on us. Steve, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. You as well.
Part of the government's plan to unveil the budget, which is coming down April 16th, is every day for the last over a week now, they've been sort of making announcements on billions of dollars spending here, there, and everywhere and such. And the military was part of all of this in the last couple of days. Bill Blair has said that they're working on a defense policy update. And what does that mean moving forward? What does it mean for our NATO commitments? Does it mean anything? Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School and Foreign Policy Relations, University of Toronto. And here now, Jack, as always, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
You
So, Jack, is this window dressing? What does this mean? Is this just part of the pre-budget banter?
In part, it is. The government, I think, is keenly aware that there has been pressure from our allies to spend more on defense, particularly in the Arctic, which is our own backyard, is increasingly an area of Russian buildup, possible Chinese involvement, and climate change is making the waterways more navigable. There's also the fact that Arctic security is one of the areas of defense spending that's relatively popular with the Canadian public. But the more you look at the details of this document, the less satisfying it really is. It talks about spending $8 billion over 5 years and $73 billion over 20 years. Projections for 20 years out are pretty close to sheer wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. A lot of the spending is taking place in the out years, which is a problem. And even in some of the areas where there has been talk about doing a lot, like acquiring submarines, which we dearly need, the government's commitment is to study and explore and consider options rather than to actually go ahead with purchases. There's also the fact that one of the priorities addressed by this document is fixing the gap in military personnel. We're about 15,000 short, 15 or 16,000 short of our on-paper strength. So that means devoting more resources to salaries, recruitment bonuses, speeding up the training process. And all of that is going to take up a larger share of the overall defense budget. The more money that's spent on that, the less it's available for these badly needed equipment purchases. So what I fear we're going to see is that all these capital projects, in part because of our politics, in part because of our broken procurement process, will be stretched out over a longer period of time. So all this military hardware is going to take longer to arrive. It's going to cost more to acquire. And by the time we finally get it, it's no longer going to be cutting edge. A lot of it will, in fact, be obsolescent. So it becomes harder to maintain, to obtain spare parts, to keep it in, to keep it fit for service. So we would continue to have a military that was under-equipped and under-prepared.
Apparently, we last did this in 2017. That was only a few years ago. And at that point, government set the priorities for the next 20 years. Is there anything different between then and now?
The emphasis on the Arctic is somewhat new. It's more of a geographical focus. There's a lot of rhetoric about this being an age of more intense great power competition, but you can argue that was apparent even when the last document came down. I think what's striking is the response from our allies been somewhat lukewarm. Ambassador Cohen from the United States said that this is a good down payment. Well, a down payment is nice, but it's far from buying the whole house or the whole car. It's just a big start. And the fact is, even when the five-year element of this plan goes through, we would still be significantly below the 2% NATO benchmark. That's something all of our allies are paying attention to.
In a poll last week, defense is creeping up as a priority for many Canadians. Does that surprise you?
No, because I think most people can read the front pages of their newspapers. They can listen to programs like yours. They know that we are in an age of international conflict in Gaza, in Ukraine. There is an increasingly aggressive China in the Asia Pacific region. So people, I think, are starting to realize the need for a greater emphasis on defense. I'm not sure how much of that will last through the next election and how far people will be prepared to go in terms of sacrificing their other desires, other priorities for defense. We'll just have to wait and see.
Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, Foreign Policy Relations, University of Toronto. Jack, as always, fascinating discussion. Thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Lots of polling going on over the last little while showing that the Liberals are not doing well. Conservatives pushing ahead of them and have been consistently for a while. The Liberals now on sort of a pre-budget tour every day right up until April 16th, and they've been doing this for a while now, dropping another little nugget of another $1 billion or a few $1 billion or whatever the program of the day is in order to spread this out over a long period of time and perhaps get you to understand the messaging and absorb the messaging a little bit better. Not sure if it's gaining ground, and one of the key demographics for the Trudeau government was the younger population, the younger side of the demo. However, it seems to be Pierre Poilievre that's gaining ground with that younger vote. To talk more about all of this, Alex Boutelier is with us, national online correspondent with Global News and Here Now. Alex, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful sunny day up here in Ottawa, so I've got my windows open for the first time this year, a week after a snowstorm, so I'm feeling pretty good this afternoon.
All right, the tulips are coming up. So what does this suggest? Because we all know this was the wheelhouse for the Prime Minister. This was a big key voting demographic for him. Why do you think things are changing, or what they have in the last 8 or 9 years?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We're seeing in polling now that among the 18 to 34 cohort, the Conservatives are in the lead, depending on where in the country, you know, in the lead by quite a bit with younger Canadians. And that's not really something that we've seen from the modern Conservative Party since it was created, to be frank. You know, heading into the 2015, 2019, and 2021 elections, the Liberals and the NDP together had, you know, a sizable chunk of that demographic committed to voting for them, which kind of jives with, you know, historically what we've seen in terms of voting preferences from younger people who tend to vote for more progressive parties, whereas the older cohorts tend to vote for more conservative parties. So this is not something that we've seen, and it's difficult to isolate exactly what's going on. We reached out to more than 60 riding associations across the country, conservative riding associations, to talk to some of those new voters who are, you know, coming to the party because of Pierre Poilievre. And in those conversations, the thing that popped out at me was that, you know, these young people are angry and they're disappointed and dissatisfied with the status quo. And right now, the alternative to the status quo, the clear alternative, is Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives. So they seem to be gravitating there. One thing that sort of also popped out at me in those conversations was it's less about specific policy proposals that Mr. Poilievre is putting out there, or the Conservatives are putting out there. And it's more about them seeing their anger and their dissatisfaction being mirrored by, you know, how Mr. Poilievre talks. You know, anybody who's seen a rally that he's conducted or a press conference that he's had in Ottawa will know that, you know, he doesn't shy away from expressing anger and expressing sort of a more sharp-elbowed, fed-up sort of approach to politics. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be resonating with a group of people who, you know, no longer, you know, can consider really owning a home, or, you know, no longer can deal with, you know, the rising cost of groceries and just general affordability. Now, that's not limited to young people, but I think young people are feeling it particularly acutely, you know, when they're trying to balance all the costs that they have to pay these days.
Do you think the way we're voting, and I know this is sort of I'm editorializing here, but do you think, Alex, the way we're voting is changing, especially younger people? I mean, it seems that, you know, if you're on the left, then everything's on the left. If you're on the right, then everything's on the right. And you see this a lot in various parts of the world, Europe and such, where, you know, they may have a very progressive or left view of one issue, but then a very conservative view or business-like view of another issue. Do you think the team politics is changing with the younger generation?
I mean, I don't think we have enough data to say for sure in any sort of comprehensive way. I will say anecdotally, you know, this is not something, you know, I'm 37 years old. This is not something that I've seen in my lifetime in terms of the appeal of a conservative party to, you know, my demographic or the demographic coming up behind me. When we look across the world, you know, we've seen a similar thing happening in places in Europe, Portugal, France, Spain, where younger generations are embracing more conservative politics. Whether or not that's, you know, because they have, you know, sat down and found out where they think they belong on the ideological spectrum, or whether or not that's just the vehicle for a rejection of what's happening right now, I think it's difficult to say. One interesting thing, you know, we import so much of our politics from the United States. You know, we tend to mirror, you know, them a few years after, you know, they make political decisions. And we're not seeing the same trend in the United States, where young people are gravitating more and more to the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. So that was sort of an interesting thing that came up in my research for this article, because you would expect us to be more sort of aligned with trends in the United States than you would, you know, Portugal or France.
That being said, Alex, I think Donald Trump is the key factor there. There's nothing like that anywhere other in the world. Do you think that people are looking for more a balance of social issues? They want to be socially conscious, but also want financial and economic decisions made that will get them in a house or wherever.
Yeah, I think, you know, when, you know, you're struggling to make ends meet, it's very hard to be, you know, large-minded about, you know, all of the sort of places that you want your country to go to and, you know, what you want to see sort of at a macro level in politics. Like, if you're worried about what your grocery bill is going to be this week, it's probably a big ask to, you know, ask you to be, you know, broad-minded about new social spending and, you know, anything that doesn't directly help your situation. So I think that that's just human nature. One question that I still have, and I think will form parts of you know, more research and a future article, is whether or not, you know, the vibes of the economy right now really match what is happening, whether or not people feel bad about the economy and that's driving this, even if they're, you know, doing better than they were a couple of years ago. Now, that's a privileged position, but I think that'll be an interesting sort of thing to explore.
Alex Boutelier with us, national online correspondent with Global News, the youth vote and where it's turning and could turn for the next election. Alex, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Anytime. Be well. Bye.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You might remember we talked about this a few weeks ago, and a high school in Oakville, Iroquois Ridge High School, that the board had decided to change the name. There was no consultation done with the Indigenous community or any community for that matter. We understand from what happened here was one anonymous person, and we don't know what their affiliation is with whatever community, that one anonymous person complained that this was Iroquois, a derogatory name, and that it should be removed. The board was very adamant about it, saying, no, the decision's been made. The name's gone. Now the decision is, what's the new name? Although that was before the backlash started and many questioning why this was going on. And we now find out that, in fact, it has all been put on hold and the motion has been recalled. And at this point, there will be no name change until further investigation, perhaps with the community that it was thought to offend. Let's bring in Jody Harbour, the co-founder of Grandmother's Voice, an Indigenous cultural organization in Oakville, and here now. Jody, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks.
Are you surprised at this? Are you surprised, Jody, this has happened?
I'm happy it's happened. You know, I went in just hoping that they would hear what needed to be said and what needed to be heard. So I'm happy that they've thought, you know, are thinking about it and have, you know, are starting to think about what needs to change in within their programming, policies, conduct.
And you, your organization or any, I don't believe, cultural organization, Indigenous cultural organization was even consulted on this. You do not find the name offensive. Is that accurate?
I don't myself. It's a personal journey that I'm on and have been on my whole life. I only knew myself as Iroquois, and that's what all my father knew, who died quite young at 52, only knowing he was Iroquois. And there's, you know, it's a big historical name. I think that it means, it has so much meaning to it, you know, different meaning. And, you know, knowing that it was used as a colonial term for the Haudenosaunee people, you know, that's obviously, I think, where people find the derogatory term from. But the school was named after an actual geographical place, as you know, area of land that became a ridge. So it was called, it's called Iroquois Ridge. So it's not like they're referring to Iroquois people. It's an actual space and place. And my, from what I know from the principal that came up with that name, he did a lot of care and research and consultation with community back then. And so, yeah, I think that this was just something that was pushed through, you know, I could see that it, you know, it may have triggered some people to say, yes, you know, hey, yeah, let's look at this name. But I don't know. I'm on the receiving end of it. And I feel like I'm glad it was that we were heard, that it wasn't me only speaking. It was weeks that I was thrusted into conversations with community members, and whether the board or whoever thinks that I'm just one voice is all that is really needed from, you know, under the UNDRIP, you know, act. And that's in our constitution. So I just think that, yeah, they acted quickly, and I'm glad that they heard. And I'm really happy with the support that we received from our trustees, and the attention that it got to media. This is a really, consultation is what's needed to be embedded in everything that we do in our communities. Because the reality is if we don't do consultation, people get hurt. That's it, bottom line. And so I don't believe they did consultation with the people that they should have done consultation with. And you know, I'm not going to say, you know, the video is there for people to watch the actual delegation and the meeting. And it is what it is. And so we're happy with the decision, and let's see what happens now. What I do have to add, though, is what I was disappointed about was that I'm not sure that they understood that pulling it back and then saying, hey, let's have the Indigenous community decide on this name. I felt like that was just putting the pressure back on, you know, the backs of the Indigenous people. Here, we don't know who made this decision, but let's just put it out there and let the Indigenous people go at it and see what they come up with. Like that to me was like more projection of, you know, lateral competition and oppression.
And haven't you already made your decision by standing up for the name Iroquois Ridge? That's your name. That's right. What you want it to be. Go ahead, Jody.
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, I like to think that one voice isn't important enough, especially when I myself and maybe three other Indigenous community members that are like their children go to this school, our Mohawk, our Haudenosaunee. I mean, I don't think it should go any further if the parents that go to that school don't find it a derogatory term. That's consultation enough. Like, why do we have to leave it to people that don't live directly in the community?
That's my next question, Jody, is that from what we understand, this was one suggestion from one person, and that person is anonymous. If the Indigenous community was not consulted, are we to assume that person is not Indigenous?
And I think, like, I don't know that it wasn't anonymous. I think they were protecting the name. The person, like, why? And then that's the other thing that was kind of just, it was, you know, bothersome to me, but like at the end of the day, it's a system. So saying that my voice or one voice, or, you know, that why is my voice more important than other person's? And I'm like, well, the person you're protecting, like if we do consultation, I know our Indigenous community is saying we won't consult with anything until we know who brought this forward. So let's be straight. Yeah, well, you know, come on, we can't do this work if we're not truthful and transparent and honest. And the seven grandfather teachings, like that's what we're trying to change in our society, a society that was developed, a country that was built off of genocide, colonization, in taking, stealing, raping, pillaging, whatever you want to say. we've left these values of Indigenous people out of these systems, and we wonder why we continue to, do the same things over and over again. It's just, this is common sense to me. And we had to deal with the, that whole approach that they use. I was confused. I'm sitting there going, what the, like, thank goodness people, there are people that are patient and understand this, system that doesn't, it was crazy.
It's very bizarre. It's very bizarre to go to a school board meeting, no matter what the topic is, because it sometimes appears, and I'm not naming all of them because some of them do a fabulous job, but some of them, you just wonder what the priority is. Do you think this is, and that's just my personal opinion, do you think this is pretty much over, Jody? Because I'm guessing in order to continue with this, they're going to have to answer all those questions that you're just asking, which I'm guessing will just lead to more embarrassment for them. So this will just all disappear and Iroquois Ridge will live on.
I hope that it lives on. I hope the name stays how it is. I hope, because what came forward was the love for our community, the collectiveness, the, it's really, people started to talk more, and that's what we're really missing, right? Is I believe, COVID really changed a lot, but over the years, we became really siloed and we're not doing what we should be doing in community the way that, maybe at, one time was. So I hope that they're really going to look at their policies. That's what my understanding was. That's what they said. The chair of the board came right up to me. I was really moved by, emotion that was felt in the room by trustees that probably felt that they weren't, they weren't shared the proper information. They need to do some work. Let's just say that. I think that that's fair to say that, if you have a policy, if you have a relationship with your partner, you have a consultant, what work are they really doing to make change? And that is the important thing. Like, look at these policies that we're missing, very important Indigenous law, which is consultation. And I think that is what's going to have to really be on the forefront of a lot of these conversations, every level of government and communities that are now getting back into really, what does it mean to include everybody? Right. So
consultation with everybody, as you said. Well, good for you, Jody. Jody Harbour with us, a co-founder of Grandmother's Voice, an Indigenous cultural organization in Oakville. The controversy around Iroquois Ridge High School and the name change seems to be subsiding as they've pulled back on the decision to rename the school. Jody, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. You too. Take care.
Housing affordability crisis will hit even more alarming levels in the coming years without a bold set of reforms to boost supply, the Economics Department at the Royal Bank of Canada said in a report on Monday. The headline in the Globe and Mail, Canada's housing crisis poised to worsen without major reforms. To talk more about all of this and what sort of major reform, let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, here now. Ian, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
So what sort of major reforms, Ian? What else can be done?
First off, this is a very, very important paper. I don't consult any of this industry whatsoever, not to banks, not to mortgage lenders. But this particular report by the Royal Bank of Canada should be read by everybody in Canada who cares or is interested in housing. It is not arm waving. It is not, coming up with ideology and propaganda. It's very pragmatic and very applied. So they go into the background of when the crisis emerged and why it emerged. So they, for those interested in that, what caused this, it's there. But then they move to what you just said. Okay, we're in this mess. How do we get out of it? That's what most people care about. And this is what's been lacking in our country in the debates by everybody. Lots of arm waving at 50, I call it at 50,000 feet. But they're not concrete and specific, suggestions of what we can do. So let's talk about what they're talking about. And I agree 1,000,000% with them. Prioritize construction skills amongst new immigrants. The government of Canada controls immigration through the points system. There's no point waving our arms and giving speeches. They control it. They control who, what qualifications are needed. So what the RBC is saying, we need to increase, essentially, they're saying, increase the points you get as an immigrant applicant applying to those with construction skills. Couldn't agree more. There's a real privileging right now of people who are not construction workers. There's other skills, and that's okay, but we need a lot more construction skills. Secondly, they're arguing for ambitious targets for skilled trade school enrollments. This is at the college level, so everybody knows this isn't at 50,000 feet. We need more people coming out of the high schools going to the colleges. The guidance counselors in the high schools of Ontario and across the Canada, and I've been very critical of this, and this does not make me popular, I assure you, with other professors. Okay, we have oversold universities in our country. I believe in universities. Universities are extremely important, but they're not for everybody. And there's lots of people who can have very, very good and fulfilling jobs going into the colleges. We have a desperate shortage of tradespeople. We need more electricians. We need more drywall people. We need more people, pipe fitters. And we need to get into the high schools because the high schools have failed us, failed our country in pushing our students, almost all of them, into university instead of into the trades. There's two. Three, develop new design and techniques and standards for building houses much more efficiently. Number four, they got to speed up project approvals. Our municipalities are still putting red tape in front of developers to build houses. How do we know this? Because the number of houses in our country being built each year is going down, not up. And they can, again, you know, shout the world's on fire and the environment and all this. This is just obfuscation to avoid responsibility for addressing the problem. We've got to ease zoning restrictions is their fourth recommendation. So these are very concrete proposals. I would add one more. I appeared multiple times before the City of Ottawa, the Economic Development Committee, I know this is going on in Hamilton. I know it's going on in Toronto. I know it's going on in Vancouver. The moment you talk about expanding the urban boundary of the city of Toronto or Hamilton, they go crazy, and a gazillion people, and I'm exaggerating, a lot of people show up who do not represent the silent majority to stop it. And it is, let me be even stronger, okay? CMHC says we need up to 5 million housing units in the next several years. We're building 230,000 a year. And we are told over and over, we got it, densification. I'm not against densification, but we are being sold fraudulent snake oil by progressives. Sorry, I know that's strong, but they're saying, no, we can put everybody into densification, which means into the urban center. The idea we can put 5 million new homes into Ottawa center and the center of Ottawa, the urban core, and Toronto and Hamilton and Vancouver and Montreal is fraudulent. It is dishonest. They're refusing to acknowledge we've got to build more houses on the edges of our cities, as we have done around the world for 2,000 years. For anybody who has visited London or Paris or any city anywhere, you know that the city keeps expanding on the edges. But we've been told lately, and there's lots of people have bought into this, we can do it all with densification. You never hear them talking about building new suburban tracks because they say that's urban sprawl. They have demonized it. And this is causing social harm. This is socially irresponsible of these people for doing that.
Dr. Ian Lee with us, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. The housing crisis continues. Ian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
We've been talking about foreign interference for an awfully long time. You might remember the Globe and Mail all over this. Also, former Global reporter Sam Cooper. Lots of chatter about interference in the last two elections. The Prime Minister pretty much denying this, not telling us what he knew when. And obviously, that led to the David Johnston fiasco and eventually the inquiry, which is going on now into foreign interference. Now we're finding out, and this was just
just submitted last night that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, received briefings about foreign interference allegations related to former Liberal MP Han Dong's riding before the 2019 election, says the document. Also mentioned in an interviewer summary, say Trudeau was informed of the allegations related to the riding of Don Valley North in late September, early October of 2019. The federal election was held October 21st of 2019. Duff Conacher with us, co-founder of Democracy Watch. Duff, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you.
So, Duff, we've always asked the question, what the Prime Minister knew and when. Do you know that now?
We know about this particular situation, that there was information passed on. It was intelligence, so it's not something that would necessarily hold up in a court of law. There was just a question to the Prime Minister's staff that went are testifying right now. Before the inquiry. And the question was, in addition to the interference in Don Valley North on Dong's riding, was there a actual tape of the reported conversation that he had with diplomats from China who are here in Canada concerning the issue of the two Michaels that China essentially detained and kidnapped. And of course, there's been reports about what he said during that conversation. Mm-hmm. And the question asked this afternoon was, is there actually a tape? And counsel for the inquiry commissioner undertook to see whether they can answer that question or whether it is a matter of national security to keep that evidence, even the existence of that evidence, a secret. So, lots of questions being raised. And in terms of the Prime Minister, there are, of course, serious questions about why he didn't react in some way when learning this information about Han Dong.
How much wiggle room is there for the Prime Minister now that this is all starting to come out? Because it seems that it's not the Prime Minister's office is saying, well, you know, it's the process that's flawed here. We're just following the rules, whether they're bending them or not. Are we learning that much more? Is there wiggle room here for the Prime Minister?
I think what's been confirmed most is that, and that really corners the Prime Minister, is that pretty much everybody who the Prime Minister set up to enforce rules on and monitor foreign interference are handpicked by the Prime Minister or his cabinet, and they serve at the pleasure of the Prime Minister and his cabinet. Mm. And people like that are not going to impartially and effectively enforce the rules. And that's what's been shown, is there was instances of interference that were confirmed misinformation about a conservative candidate out in Vancouver, and they took no action. But when there was misinformation posted about the Prime Minister on an internet site, they took action. So when you have people who are watching and enforcing, who are handpicked by the ruling party cabinet, they're going to, and they serve at the pleasure of the ruling party cabinet and the Prime Minister, then they're going to favor the Prime Minister and the ruling party. And it's not an impartial or effective system at all. So that's been definitely confirmed from the testimony, and that puts them in a corner about, why did you not set up a more independent, impartial system? Why did you set up such a partisan political system that was under your control?
Could the answer be because it benefited their party?
Well, it just leaves that question hanging, and that's enough to damage the Prime Minister. I mean, the chief electoral officer was handpicked by the Prime Minister. And yes, the House of Commons has to approve who heads up our Elections Canada, the chief electoral officer. But when you have a majority, which they did at the time they chose the head of elections, the current head [S2] Right. [S1] Of Elections Canada, then you're going to get that vote in the House of Commons. So even the head person running our elections was handpicked by the ruling party through a questionable process. And we just cannot have that. That does not enhance or maintain the public's confidence in the integrity of the system when it's so partisan and political. It needs to be independent and impartial, and there, and as a result, it's going to be more effective just by design.
We remember at the beginning of all of this, the prime minister denied this. He even played the racism card. That's how we got to the David Johnston inquiry and such. And now where we are today, what are you expecting from the prime minister when he testifies tomorrow?
Unfortunately, more of the same as we've seen in past scandals, We Charity, SNC-Lavalin, a person who gives excuses, actually misleads again and again and again until completely cornered, and then apologizes, but always with a qualification. And that's how he operates. He's operated that way in every scandal. And I hope he does apologize for setting up a system that he claimed was aimed at stopping foreign interference. But really, in terms of the rules, and the fact that everyone who ran the system were people who served at his pleasure, that had been handpicked by his cabinet, was really a system designed to cover up foreign interference, not effectively stop it or prevent it.
Are you convinced with the information that's coming out now, Duff, that you will get answers to all of the questions or most of the questions that you've asked or you want answered?
No, there's still this issue of two big issues with the information. One, yes, the spy agencies say that they have, national security agencies say that they have turned over all of the documents to the commission lawyers, unredacted. So they all have top security clearance, these lawyers. They've looked at all the documents, and there's still going to be a fight over what actually can be disclosed. If anyone has watched the hearings, when they put up a document, there's usually half a page is missing.
Yeah.
The second thing is that the Trudeau cabinet has withheld documents from the commission and the inquiry. And so the question is, what's in those documents? And we still don't know. We filed a request with the commission lawyers and the commissioner to get public answers and make them public as to why these documents have been withheld. They were also withheld from David Johnston. That came out in the first round of hearings in February. So if you don't have all the documents, you don't know what really happened. And some of the documents are withheld. And in terms of the public, some of the documents that have been turned over are never going to be disclosed, parts of the content of those docs. And that means part of the story is going to be covered up.
Duff Conacher with us, co-founder of Democracy Watch. The inquiry into foreign interference continues. The Prime Minister did receive briefings regarding allegations to former Liberal MP Han Dong's riding before the 2019 election. Duff, thanks for the time. Be well. Good luck.
Thanks for your interest. I'll keep you updated as things develop.
If you've got a kid with peanut allergies, you might be interested in this because it's obviously a great concern over the course of their childhood and right up into adulthood. McMaster University pediatric allergy expert Douglas Mack says new guidelines for oral immunotherapy will help make building up tolerance to allergies like peanuts safer and more sustainable for families. To talk more about all of this, Douglas Mack with us, lead author of the paper and assistant clinical professor with McMaster's Department of Pediatrics. And here now, Douglas, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to talk.
Douglas, I've got two kids. They're 16 and 21 right now, 17 and 21, somewhere like that. And both had peanut allergies as a kid and egg allergies. They outgrew the egg allergies, still have the peanut. But I certainly know what it was like being a parent during this time, because back then it was a little different than what it is now. How has it changed? Or the thoughts?
Yeah, you're totally right on. You know, when I first started doing this, we would, exactly as you're saying, diagnose and say, come back in a couple of years, here's your epinephrine. But what we've been doing now over the past several decades now is developing a procedure where you start with very, very small amounts of whatever the child is allergic to, whether it's peanuts or tree nuts or milk or whatever. And we gradually, over a period of 6 to 12 months or sometimes longer, build them up so that they can have often around 2 or so peanuts, sometimes much higher than that. And what this does is provide a buffer so that if they have an accidental exposure, for example, that we aren't looking at a more severe reaction or no reaction whatsoever. And so that's called oral immunotherapy for food. And it's something that we've been doing in our clinic now for well over a decade.
So is this a regular practice now? Is this standard procedure if your kid gets diagnosed with an allergy such as this?
We are seeing it becoming the standard of care. There is now a commercial product available in the United States and other parts of Europe. And so we are seeing it being used more commonly. I think one of the challenges that we're facing is that, if you can imagine, because we're using what that child is allergic to, you can have reactions during this process. And I think that that's, you know, we give the dose, but the patient brings that dose home they're taking it every single day over that 2 to 4 week period. So yes, when they're in the office, if they have a reaction, it can be mild, it can be moderate, it can be severe, and I can watch for that. But when they go home, these families are put in a scenario where they have to be able to identify the reactions to decide, you know, is this a mild reaction? Is this a more severe reaction? Do I need epinephrine? Do I need to contact call 911 and go to the emergency department? Are there other side effects that might be a bit more subtle that they may or may not know about or may not pick up on? Or are there other conditions that make this inherently unsafe? For example, like uncontrolled asthma. And so there's a ton of responsibility. If you can imagine, you know, we tell you for years, avoid this. And now we're saying, hey, now we're going to start having you give this to your child. These families have a lot of responsibility. They're forced to function like basically amateur medical professionals. And, you know, the reality, none of these people have had, very few have had formal medical training. And I think this is a perspective I think we were missing when we started doing oral immunotherapy. And when we look at some of the data, about a third of families that are going through OIT have had no formal training in how to even do OIT. They've had actually no informed consent. And so when we decided to make these guidelines, that was really the target. We wanted to make sure that families were well, could really appreciate what they were doing, have all the information they need. And that's what we did.
So obviously this goes far beyond the meeting or the appointment in the doctor's office, because this is something that does have to be administered daily. So therefore at home, as opposed to in the doctor's office, does this come in a prescription form, like a pill? You would take a certain amount every day, or is it one peanut, two peanuts? How does it work?
Yeah, great question. I mean, in the United States and in parts of Europe, there is a commercial product where that's pre-measured. What we do in Canada is there are several approaches that we've taken. All of them involved either pharmacy prescribed and compounded types of products, capsules, solutions, et cetera. And they are gradually increased based on protocols that we've developed. And eventually, you know, down the road, 6 months, a year down into this, these patients are able to actually have peanuts. That's their dose. And it's pretty amazing to see these kids being able to take these peanuts on a daily basis. Sometimes they're M&Ms, sometimes they're, you know, whatever. And it's very cool to see. As you can imagine, some of these kids don't love the taste of this. And I think, because for so many years they've been told to avoid this, but yes, it's pretty amazing to see this transformation where they can now actually eat peanuts. It's quite surreal and can be stressful for families.
I can imagine that, but also here to help you, we're going to give you this candy, this M&Ms. That's amazing. So would it be different for every single patient? I mean, there's some you would feel comfortable doing with this, others, no, too severe.
Yeah. I think when we, look at this, and I think that's part of what we want to do with these guidelines, is to identify who is a higher risk patient and who is kind of a low risk patient. What are the contraindications for this? And I think, you know, so a patient who may be higher risk might be example for an older patient. I'm sorry to say, if they have uncontrolled asthma, they're absolutely not a patient. That was one of the contraindications that we identified during our study. If they have poor compliance, if they have overwhelming anxiety, if there are social factors that may not allow us to give this on a regular basis, you know, and I think that there are numerous things that we looked at that may affect the ability for the patient to do this. I will say the younger the patient, the better. And that was one of the things that we recommended as well, that a young patient may look at, not a cure. We talk about remission in some of these younger patients. And so, yes, I would say that younger is better. And so we're even doing this down to 6 months of age at this point.
That was going to be my next question, Douglas, was at what age do you start this? Does it have to be during the developmental stage, the early years? Can you venture into this as a teen or an adult?
We absolutely do this in adults and teens. Sometimes, to be frank with you, that 16 or 17-year-old who is just mature and really wants to do this, they're committed to doing this, is sometimes much easier than, even than a difficult or anxious 8 or 9-year-old, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I think I will say that, you know, if I were to pick an age, I'm going to want to do this in my younger patients, even ideally shortly after diagnosis, if possible, but certainly in the first few years, the sooner the better. They just tend to be more malleable. Once again, that isn't to say we can't do the older kids, but the younger kids are more malleable. Their immune systems have not quite matured, and they tend to have less side effects during this process. That isn't all of them, I can assure you. Some of my younger kids have been very, very challenging. But I would say if I were to pick, I'm gonna err towards that end for sure.
So what's the message, Douglas, to parents who have kid allergies here?
Yep. I think I think realistically, we do have treatment options. They're not for everybody. And we have others that are coming out, like peanut patches, sublingual immunotherapy tablets that go under the tongue. So we have other things that are coming. I think no matter what families decide to do, however, when they meet with their allergist, they need to ensure that that allergist is going to ensure that they follow a protocol to identify what challenges may exist, that they provide adequate informed consent for them. So these families know exactly what they are getting into, what this entails, and what this means to them, the child, and their family. Do as much research as you can, but also insist that the physician that's providing it provides you with that information upfront and during the process. It'll keep them safer and to be far more successful.
McMaster, studying the way we diagnose, the way we treat, kids with allergies. Douglas Mackwith is lead author of the paper and assistant clinical professor with McMaster's Department of Pediatrics. Douglas, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
These allegations of election interference by the Chinese Communist Party came about a while ago with a Globe and Mail article from Stephen Chase and Sam Cooper from Global News talking. And then from then, the question was, what and when did the Prime Minister know about interference in the last two elections? You might remember the Prime Minister blew all this off, refused to call a public inquiry, actually played the race card when this was first brought up by the media. And then that's how we got to David Johnston, and that blew up, and we've got the inquiry where we are right now. And we've just found out from last night, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau did, in fact, receive briefings about foreign interference allegations related this time to former Liberal MP Han Don's riding before the 2019 election. And it was brought into the inquiry on Monday evening. To talk more about all of this, Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He's here now. Scott, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
You know who I'm better than today, Scott?
Who?
You mentioned his name already. I mean, look, this looks bad on our prime minister, and there's lots of questions that I think we have to ask about what he didn't do. Especially when you consider that we heard last week or the week before that they had demanded that a fake Facebook story come down
against them.
But here, when it's against the other guys, we don't mention anything and we sort of say, oh, it's no big deal. But that's sort of expected. That, you know, the prime minister, he now looks like he's got a mess on his hands. The guy who it looks even worse, if that's imaginable right now, is David Johnston. How can you, our rapporteur, how can you do what he did, get paid what he did to come back with a report that now looks like it bears no resemblance to the truth or to the facts whatsoever?
But to David Johnston's defense, and he said this in his report, it is based on the very limited information that the government had given him at that point, and this inquiry has evidence that he did not receive, from what I'm understanding.
Fair enough. Although I will say this, if you are going to take that role, yeah, I don't know that you should be willing to take that role if what you're saying is, I am going to be presenting a document that I have no faith that it is right, but you've asked me to come up with some half-ass thing that nobody really, like, surely, I believe David Johnston is a man of integrity. I do. And I am disappointed in him that he would have been willing to take on a job if he, in fact, truly believed there was no way to get an honest, real answer to this. At that point, you say, sorry, my credibility, my life's work, my name matters more than taking on a job here that I cannot stand behind if I don't believe I've got the information. I would have expected him, that's my disappointment with him, I would have expected him to say, I can't do that if there's no way I can do this properly.
The prime minister's staff will be blaming this on the process. Well, you know, the process is flawed. We're just following the process here, whether they're taking advantage of that or not. Is it the process or is it the people involved? Because again, it's clearly obvious now that this was designed to benefit the Liberals.
Well, what do you mean? The process as far as him being briefed on stuff? If what he's going to argue after what we've heard this week is that, well, yeah, maybe my staff heard something, but they never told me, then what the appropriate response should be at that moment is, this was serious enough that I am announcing today that every single person in my office who was part of that is fired immediately and will be escorted out of the building by security. This is serious.
And this note that came out from the evidence from last night is he did receive briefings about foreign interference, especially regarding this one MP. He did receive it.
And so what I'm saying is if somehow now the argument is going to be, well, that's mistaken, I never got those, then the only other option then is my staff is either so corrupt or so incompetent that they cannot be entrusted with information like this. This is significant information for the security of our country and our elections and our democracy. And if what he's going to say is my staff failed at a level this big, they cannot work for me anymore. I cannot have them in there. I don't think he will fire anybody because that doesn't seem to be the way this is done. Nobody is ever accountable for anything. There's never accountability, Scott.
Does this resonate with Joe Jane Canadian?
It's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. And the reason I would say under normal circumstances, it would. But I think we've reached a point of...
We just don't believe anything he says.
Well, not that. I just think that every week there's another story about something that's happened. I mean, just today we learned that his trip, his 6-day trip, his pan-Indonesian happiness mission or whatever it was, cost taxpayers $2 million, according to a report, including $200,000 in on-flight catering. It just, at what point have people just shut it down and go, there's something every week I can't keep track of. Like, I would have thought that as a prime minister, honestly, and let's backtrack for a few years, I would have thought for any other prime minister, the blackface thing would have been the end of it. But clearly there is just this din, this fog now of endless stories that when you say, is this going to affect people? I think people have almost just become so numb and so used to it that they've almost tuned out the details. You would think that an inquiry being told that the leader of the country ignored reports that a foreign government was affecting our elections would be an unbelievable explosion of a story. And I don't know. Is it? I don't know.
It's racism. All right, Scott Radley, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great show, Scott.
I shall do my best. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Bud. Scott, overheard solar eclipse is a once-in-a-lifetime deal. Just like seeing the Leafs win the Stanley Cup. Oh! Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.